Welcome to Digital Stratosphere, the podcast that helps organizations throughout the world with their digital transformation journeys. Here, you will find independent and technology-agnostic advice with no software vendor sales spin to help you make the best decisions for your organization. Whether you are in the process of selecting technology, in the midst of your transformation, or trying to get your initiative back on track, Digital Stratosphere provides expertise and best practices to help. And now, we turn it over to your host, Sarah Dokowitz.
Hello and welcome to Digital Stratosphere, the podcast that provides independent and technology agnostic advice to help organizations through their digital transformation journeys. This show will help you dial in on what it takes to drive a successful digital transformation, from the high-level strategies to the detail-oriented practices that you may not have otherwise known. You'll learn about best practices and premier strategies used by industry leaders who have driven millions of dollars in net positive business transformations. And over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll cover the things you need to know to make your digital transformation successful. My name is Sarah Dokowitz, and I'm your host, and thank you so much for joining us today. In today's episode, we are going to dive into what it takes to optimize your digital strategy. We live in a tech-driven world where there is no business if there is no technology supporting it. But just how do you tie your business strategy and your digital strategy together to optimize your operations? Joining me for the conversation today is Stuart Robb, Vice President of Third Stage Consulting Europe. Third Stage is an independent and technology-agnostic digital transformation consulting firm that operates on a global scale. Stuart and his team have worked with some of the world's leading organizations in their transformation journeys, and they have guided various organizations in establishing a sound and effective digital strategy. Hey, Stuart, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you doing, Sarah?
Always a good time chatting with you, and I'm very, very well. And so I want to get into this interview with you because you recently spoke at Third Stage's monthly Full Throttle workshop on this topic, and it sparked a few questions and topics that I wanted to discuss with you. So it sounds like at a high level, the future state of the business is what will drive all strategic planning. So could you tell me a bit more about what the future state vision should entail? Like, how granular do visionaries need to get when it comes to defining the business goals that will help them reach their targeted future state?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I guess the simple answer is the vision needs to be crisp and clear enough that everyone can get behind it and understand it and know where the executives want to take the company. So a typical vision would have something like maybe a three-year lifespan. And would set out, you know, it could be a very simple vision. It could be in 3 years' time, we will have grown our business by 25% or whatever the number is. Mm-hmm. And I've seen visions as vague as that. And the ones that I think tend to be more effective are the ones that really have specific goals. So something like, you know, by 2025, we're going to have a new operating model underpinned by a new ERP and global harmonized processes. And that will lead to cost savings of 20%. And that's a really crisp vision. Now, you'll notice that it's quite light on specifics. And that's okay, because when you get into your strategic initiatives and your business drivers and all the other and your strategies and all the other stuff that goes to encompass your vision, that's what will help you to understand how you will realize that vision. But we've found that having a vision, particularly if you're doing a large transformation, is really important, because it's the key message that your executives are giving to your employees that say, this is what this is going to be all about. And, you know, this is what we want to achieve.
Yeah, totally. Without the vision, you don't really have anywhere else to go, because, like, where are we going at the end of the day, right? And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it sounds like in your experience too, many companies are often not looking at the core drivers of their business to create their goals and objectives. And like, sure, maybe some companies want to be better on social media or drive their e-commerce presence, but are those things relevant when it comes to aligning your business and digital strategy? And what core drivers should a business focus on instead, if that's the case?
Yes. So that's again a good question. You're right to say that companies tend not to focus on core drivers. In fact, quite a lot of companies don't really understand what their core drivers are. They understand they want to make profit and they don't want to make a loss. But, you know, even some quite well-known brands, particularly over here in the UK, you know, don't have any key measures that are driving that view of profitability. You know, so if I'm making a widget, well, how much is it costing me to make that widget? How long is that widget sitting in inventory before it's actually sold? You know, how many returns am I getting on that widget? Those are key metrics that drive profitability. And if you don't understand what's going into those metrics and how those metrics align, then it's impossible to manage your business. And I was saying to somebody earlier today, it's astonishing that some very profitable companies, because they're very profitable, don't have really good sight of what the underlying drivers of their business are. And, you know, part of the reason that they don't is because they're profitable. They don't think they need to do anything. And, of course, that's all very well when you are very profitable. But as soon as you start not being very profitable, if you don't understand why that's happened, you're dead in the water. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about some techniques that you can use to help uncover that a little bit later on.
Yeah, it's so important. Like, people don't realize, like you were saying, it's just because you're making so much money, it's really important to know where it's coming from, because at the end of the day, the data is what's going to help drive you into, you know, what other kind of endeavors you might have as well. So let's talk a bit about the data. So you touched on the importance of understanding data flow before ever opening the door to another software implementation. So what should companies have a clear foundational understanding of when it comes to their data flow, and why is that so important?
Oh, that's a very foundational question. If you're going to do an ERP, and obviously it depends a little bit on how complex your business is and how old it is, but if you're going to do an ERP, basically that's the heart of the company. It's the operating system of the company. And so if you're going to muck about with that, if you're going to take that heart out and do heart surgery on it and put a different heart in, and you don't know where all the veins are and where all the arteries are and which way the blood's flowing, then you are going to kill the patient really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And so in a business context, if you don't know where the data is sourced, if you don't know what the master of that data is and what systems are mastering it, if you don't understand where that data is going and what is transforming it, and if you don't know how that data ends up being used and what reporting it's feeding, then you don't know anything about what's going to happen if you take a bit in the middle out and put something else in its place. And I've seen a variety of companies try and, I would say, bodge around the solution by, well, let's just replicate everything that comes in and let's just replicate everything that comes out and try and pretend it's the same, but of course it never is. And so all of the reporting goes haywire. Nobody really can believe anything that they read. You start getting incorrect data feeding master systems, and the whole thing ends up being a total nightmare. So the investment in understanding your data architecture and how data is flowing from its source and through all of the upstream and downstream touch points that it has and into what reports it's feeding is so important. And we see a lot of organizations that get into an ERP and they're starting to configure it and what have you, and they haven't actually thought about how they're going to deploy it or what happens when this ERP lands and the old ERP is, you know, taken out of the body and the new one put in, and what that's going to do to the data. And it's a little bit dependent on how big and complex the organization is, but most SME-sized organizations and above have got to have that clarity around data. Otherwise, it's just going to be a total mess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to kind of touch on target operating models and how they tie in with articulating your organizational strategy. So what does a target operating model entail?
Oh, well, so if you think of a company, you can think of it in three parts. You can think of a company as having a purpose. So if I'm a mining company, my purpose is to dig minerals out of the ground and sell them. And so I might have regulatory compliance to be able to do the digging and dispose of the waste. I might have shareholders or investors, and I might have various frameworks that are in which I have to fit. So the purpose of that company will be to go and do mining and to return to provide a return on investment for the shareholders. So that's very different to a charity like Oxfam or someone whose job is not to dig minerals out of the ground, it's to go and help the poor in Africa. And they don't have shareholders, they're a not-for-profit, and they have Charities Commission as their regulator. So they are totally different businesses with different purposes. So if you then move to the second part of a business, you have what's called its value proposition. And its value proposition is what it offers to the market. So the mining company offers minerals to anyone who wants to buy whatever minerals or oil or whatever it is they're digging up. Oxfam, its value proposition is to help the needy. So it's producing boxes of medicines and blankets and tents and whatever. And that's completely different from the mining company. And then the third thing is how you execute. So if you've got your purpose and you've got your value proposition, what I am going to sell, what I'm going to offer, then you have to deliver on that offer in some way. So if you are a manufacturer, you will be building something. If you are a charity like Oxfam, you will be, creating up tents and buying tents in and having them flown out. And so it's all of those components in terms of how you deliver is what's referred to as an operating model. So it has a number of dimensions, and this is not exclusive. So the traditional Harvard way of describing an op model is that it's people, process, and technology. So a set of processes that happen in logical sequence that's done by people, that's underpinned by technology, is how we deliver our value proposition, our product, or our service to our customer. Now, then some bright sparks, I think it might have been at BSG, actually, can't remember which one it was, or Booz Allen, decided that data was also important. So then you got people, process, technology, and data. And data kind of lived on its own, because you can have data in the forms of written data or or systems data or what have you. And then somebody thought it would be a good idea to add security. So now you've got people, process, technology, data, security. And then that could be physical access security or internet protection, or it could be security as in governance, risk, and compliance. So now you've got this expanding list of attributes that could be form the basis of a target operating model. And I am not particularly fussed about what those dimensions are. As far as I'm concerned, any dimension that goes to make up how we deliver our service or our product is part of the operating model, whether that's data, whether it's social media, whether it's a report, whether it's a security model, whatever it is, that operating model is how we deliver. Now, the mistake a lot of companies make, particularly when they start on a transformation, is they don't start with the vision of what do we want to be in the future? How do we want to work? Okay. What they start with is our Oracle's getting a bit old and crusty. Let's go and find another one. And so where they start from is the wrong place. So they don't start with you know, we're 20 years out of date in how we do our business. We want to be 100% bang up to date. We want maximum automation. We want maximum, process efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to design a new business and, by the way, we'll get rid of this old rubbishy technology and put some new technology in whilst we do it. That's the right way to do it. What they normally do is, let's get some Oracle in, let's write a list of requirements, let's have several thousand of them that are all based on the current state, because nobody's actually gone to think about what the future state actually ought to look like. So they've described what they do today, not what they want to do tomorrow, and then they go and buy the tool. And then the tool lands and the CD-ROM arrives and you shove the CD-ROM in the CD-ROM drive. I know it's all cloud now, but bear with me. And then they start configuring it and they go, but hang on a minute, where are all these promised business benefits that we're going to get from this fangly, wonderful new tool? And you're not going to get any, because all you've done is replicated what you do today. You haven't designed for the future. So when you are doing a transformation program, the wrong answer is, what technology do we want? The right answer is, what do we want the future of our business to look like and how do we want it to work? And let's think across all dimensions of process, people, technology, data, security, and everything. And when we've understood all of those dimensions, let's go and pick a tool or tools that most closely meets that object, that operating model.
Yeah, so many great examples in the way that you just explained that too. And it's just really interesting to hear like the foundational elements that play into scaling and growing a business. So definitely a lot of information there.
And actually, that's a good point. I mean, a company that did something 20 years ago will tend to think that's not only the right way of doing it, but the only way of doing it. Yeah. And actually, when you have grown, you've expanded from a 10 million to 100 million or a 100 million to a 500 million, those processes don't necessarily expand and cater for a new, you know, a much larger organization. And actually rethinking how you do some of your key processes as you grow, you know, is a really important refresh to do. And that's why it really is such a wasted opportunity if you're going to replace your ERP and replace your ERP or your HCM or any other thing, and don't think about what the new process architecture is going to look like and how you're going to leverage automation and how you're going to utilize AI and all of this stuff. It's baffling to me, actually, how many companies I go into that say, yeah, we're going to replace, you know, SAP with something. And I go, great, why is that going to benefit you? And they go, because it's going to be new technology. And I go, well, great, what are you going to use it for? And they go, well, we're going to use the new technology. And I went, good, like AI? And they go, oh, yeah, we're going to use AI. And I said, what for? And they go, well, we're going to use it. We're going to leverage it. And we're going to use the analytics. And we're going to get all this stuff. And I went, yes, but what specifically? I mean, honest to God, this is a real conversation. What specifically are you going to use AI to do? And they went, well, specifically, we're going to use AI to do some analytics and we're going to use it to improve our customer service. And I'm like, you know, you just want to kill yourself at that point. But that's the thing. You know, if you cannot describe to me or you or to all of your colleagues in your company where this is all going, where you're heading, where you're going to end up, then your transformation is not going to be the outstanding career-defining success that you need it to. And yeah, Starting with the technology is wrong.
Absolutely. You heard it here first from Stuart. So right now we're actually going to take a quick break. And when we do come back, Stuart and I, we're going to go deeper into the foundational elements that will help build a winning digital strategy. So we'll be right back with more of the Digital Stratosphere podcast.
If you are trying to achieve digital transformation success, turn to Third Stage Consulting Group. Third Stage's independent and technology agnostic consulting team helps clients define their digital strategies, select the right software, and manage their implementations. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Australia. Our team helps the world's most forward-thinking organizations through their transformation pitfalls and risks. Whether you are embarking on an ERP, HCM, CRM, supply chain management, or any other digital transformation, contact Third Stage Consulting to see how we can help you reach the third stage of transformation success. Learn more about us and download independent reports, videos, and other best practices at thirdstage-consulting.com.
Welcome back to the Digital Stratosphere podcast. I'm Sarah Dokovich, speaking with Stuart Robb from Third Stage Consulting. So let's jump right back in, shall we? So we've covered a handful of building blocks that help create a sound digital strategy, but I know that there is so much more. So let's get into this. So I want to talk about, you kind of mentioned earlier about architecture. So every organization has a unique system and business architecture, and some have data centers while others operate solely on the cloud, and some have full scope ERP solutions while others are utilizing the best of breed model. So can you tell me a bit about what a company needs to assess their current architecture and how that rolls into digital strategy?
Okay, so...
a mouthful.
So the direction of travel in the business at the moment is obviously towards cloud-based operation. Vendors would like you to take their service much the same way as you take electricity from the plug socket. You know, you don't worry about how the electricity is generated, and you don't worry about, for the most part, whether it's going to be there, unless you live in California, of course, where you have frequent power cuts. But in England, we have very reliable power, and so we don't have any worries or issues with our power. And that's where they'd like you that's how they'd like you to think of them. Unfortunately, ERPs are not like power sockets. And, you know, when you get 110 or 240 volts out of your power socket, you know, that is it. It is a sine wave of electricity that powers your appliances, and that's it. With an ERP, there's an infinite number of variations and variety of functions that you want it to do. And so what you are looking for in your future state architecture is the closest possible fit to the functions that your business needs. So you'll be doing effectively a fit gap. Now, there are a few challenges in that. The first is that all ERPs from the big vendors are generally averagely good at everything. So sometimes they will write additional modules, or they'll improve modules themselves. Sometimes, which is very much Infor's model, they'll just go and buy a product and then use that and integrate it into their tool to be better. But you'll generally see a leapfrogging of, you know, SAP, Oracle, Workday, et cetera, et cetera. Which are incremental improvements in capability to each one of the product suites over time. The alternative approach, which you mentioned, was called best of breed. Now, best of breed is where you take the best product in any particular constituency, and you say, I will want the best tool for each part of my business, and I'm going to worry about how to hook them all together. So you might have Oracle for financials, or NetSuite, say. You might have Workday for HR. You might have Tagetik for FP&A. You might have Hieradius for accounts receivable. You might have Proactis for accounts payable. And you can see that each one of those business functions has a world-class tier one solution supporting it. But you are orchestrating all the data going between all of them. So you need some really excellent middleware like MuleSoft or maybe Delbumi or something like that to do this data orchestration. Now, that is not a cheap way of running your business. Mm-hmm. So firstly, having bespoke best of breed solutions is going to be expensive because you're buying module by module from different suppliers. So you're not going to get economies of scale, that you'd get if you had a complete full stack solution from a single supplier. The second is that writing the integrations and keeping them up to date is not easy. And so you will definitely incur more cost in support in writing and then supporting all of these integration points. The third thing, which a lot of people don't think about, is that when you're in a best of breed environment, all of your release cycles for every product are all out of step. So your financials might be four times a year on the quarter. Your HR might be two times a year, in the middle of a quarter. And so the more products you have in the mix of best of breed, the more into a constant cycle of UAT for the next release you're going to be doing. To the point at which if you expand that thought far enough, you'll just be doing nothing but UAT in your business all year round. And obviously then there's the cost of the products themselves. I mean, you will not get a large discount for a unified solution if you're buying lots of small products from a number of vendors. And then finally, it's about unified data. And we are seeing a trend towards unified platforms now. So all from Workday, all from Oracle, all from SAP. And the reason for that is because having a consolidated data set has become increasingly important, especially when you want to start to leverage that data through AI. And having it on lots of disparate platforms or trying to consolidate it yourself into some form of data warehouse or data lake is now starting to be viewed on as really making heavy weather of something that from a vendor you could get already solved for you. So why would I have, Salesforce and Oracle and or Salesforce and SAP and Workday and have to worry about orchestrating all of that data and getting it all consolidated consistently into a data warehouse where I could just have SAP or Oracle and it could all be in one unified platform. And then they've done all of that for me and I can have the pre-built analytics and the reports. So that's probably the dimensions, the most important dimensions, architectural dimensions that you're probably going to be thinking about as of today, as of 2021.
Yeah, definitely a lot of different things to consider. And I wanted to dive into another element too of your workshop at Full Throttle, which was metrics. And obviously, nobody would be able to assess their progress in business without sound metrics. So to take it a step further, there is a particular budgeting structure that many companies are utilizing more and more to tie their metrics to the way that they spend money. It's called driver-based rolling forecasting, or in other words, beyond budgeting. So what Yes. is that and how does that work?
Okay, so I first came across this about, it was 8 years ago. And it was in an airline, actually. And the guy who ran FP&A in this airline was a bit of a rocket scientist. The airline was struggling under the weight of management reports that it was producing that were not really helping to contribute any information, useful information about the health of the airline. So what had happened was when they were a couple of aircraft, producing a 10-page management report that says these are the routes and this is how profitable they are and this is how much the planes and the fuel and all the rest of it cost us is all fine. And you can assimilate that in a two-hour board meeting and that's all great and dandy. The problem was that as they'd grown, they'd ended up with 250 aircraft and the report was well over 100 pages every month, and it was tables and tables of data, budget, actual variance, and if you were lucky, a little comment as to why there was a variance, and mostly there wasn't, and it was just page after page after page, and it was impenetrable, absolutely useless. You couldn't make any useful decisions from any of this data whatsoever. And so what this guy did was scrapped the whole airline management pack, completed the board pack and started again. And he said that in our airline, and the reason I know about this, I was the finance systems manager at the time, and we were working with him on implementing the whole BI strategy, which was built off of this. He said there are really only seven things that drive profitability in an airline. One is fuel cost, and mostly fuel cost is hedged. So actually, although fuel is important, it's actually, ironically, one of the least important factors that we worry about in terms of our overall profitability. The ones that really impact us are crew utilization and crew costs, en route costs, airport fees and parking, etc. And there were a couple of others. And he said, and the things that really we need to focus on in terms of the revenue side is our revenue per seat, utilization rate in the aircraft, and our route profitability based on occupancy. And so we ended up with seven drivers of the business, and it was basically, I think it was those seven. And the whole report was based on, the airline management report was based simply on those seven. And so if we were seeing a shortfall in occupancy rate or a shortfall in revenue per seat over the whole airline, over the 14,000 routes that it flew a year, then you would drill in one level down. And that level down would tell you, well, actually, it's the Amsterdam to Munich route that is dragging our revenue per seat down. And so you would be able to drill into that, and then you'd be able to look at the operational parameters and the environment of that particular route. You know, what was it like last year? What's it like this year? Is there any environmental factors? And the ability to run the business through those seven key drivers revolutionized the airline, because all of a sudden they were getting useful, succinct and informative data in a timely fashion. And most of this was real time. It was pseudo real time. So they had a big screen and they had all of the route maps of the airline, and you could click on it and they were red, amber, green. Actually, they were different colors, but I'd give the airline away if I said what colors they were. But you can click on the route and you can actually drill down and see what was out of kilter with the route. Now, that's driver-based management. That's driver-based information being used to manage the business. So all of the noise that goes on underneath is important, but it's not something that the senior executives should be worried about. Yeah. So that was about 8 years ago, and I didn't think too much about it. I mean, it was very impressive, and it was I thought I'd love to do that again somewhere else. Anyway, a couple of years later, I was working with another client, and oddly enough, he'd come from an aircraft parts manufacturer. And so again, there was a little bit of an airline link. I think airlines are much, much better at this than almost any other industry. And he took it one step further. Now, he said, the idea that we get to December or whatever month we get, and we say, last year you had $1 million. And so come January the 1st, we're going to reset your budget. And now you're going to have $0, and then we're going to give you another $1 million, or we're going to give you $1.1 million, or we're going to give you $0.9 million, or whatever it is. And then you're going to go through the year and spend that. And then at the end of the year, we're going to zero it again. It's called zero-based forecasting. It's totally ludicrous, because the business doesn't suddenly reset every year. Okay, yes, it does in terms of the accounts, but in terms of its operations, it carries on and on and on forever. So why are we doing this big drop-off, which actually incentivizes people to try to spend their budget out, 2 months before the end of the financial year, Or think about doing projects that may be multi-year projects, but try to do those multi-year projects in the context of trying to set annualized budgets. It makes no sense. The whole concept is total rubbish. And what he said, and this is where Beyond Budgeting comes in, and there are loads of videos on this if anyone's interested, and go to YouTube and look at it, is don't do zero budget forecast. Do driver-based rolling forecast. Do a rolling forecast. So say, let's say, for example, that I predict that my budget for printing on paper books this year is going to be $1 million. I'm going to spend $1 million on printing this year. And we get to the end of the year, and I've actually spent 1.2 million. So on zero-based budgeting, I'm fired. I've spent $200,000 more than I should have done, and therefore I haven't managed to budget, and I'm fired. Except that we did 40% more print books this year than we did last. So actually, by spending that 1.2 million, even though it's 200,000 over the budget, I've actually contributed more to profit because, although I'm over budget, we were selling more. Now, zero-based forecasting does not account for that, which is why it's such a fatally flawed way of doing budget management. You want to be able to react dynamically to that change in the business and adjust those budgets accordingly as the business is fluctuating. And so the idea of rolling-based forecasts is that you don't do an annual budget. You do a quarterly budget. And if there's any events during the course of a quarter that occur, you look at those events and you see what does that have. And you start at the top and you start on your seven or however many it is, key drivers. And you say, what impact do those events have on those seven key drivers? How are they trending? Are they trending positively or negatively? And then you can cascade from those seven down further down to say, okay, for my department then, what does that mean? Does that mean I can spend more on printing and paper because we've got the corresponding increase in sales? So it makes the whole management of business much more dynamic and actually much more realistic. I don't know whether that's explained it particularly well. I remember trying to explain this to an FP&A person. They just looked at me as if I'd gone mad because it's such an alien concept to FP&A, who are very used to this idea of zero-based budgeting. It's become the de facto way of doing it. But our companies are doing it. It's becoming increasingly popular, especially because it aligns quite well with the way that, particularly in the US, the quarterly cycles of SEC filings and things work as well. So you can actually create a much more direct relationship between your filings and your drivers, et cetera, et cetera. Driver-based rolling forecast, DBRF. And information that's a hell of a lot more insightful than the way I probably just put it, Beyond Budgeting is a thing to look up.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you explained it pretty well. And also, just like you said, it's more realistic of a kind of way to do the budgeting. So if a company is interested in migrating their budgeting approach from the typical base on last year's spend to Beyond Budgeting, what do you have advice on where they should start with that?
Don't ask me. No, seriously. I mean, it's a complex thing to do to get right to start with. There are tools out there, particularly EPM tools, FP&A tools like Tagetik or Hyperion or OneStream that can support driver-based rolling forecasts. And so one point of contact would be to go and talk to an EPM provider, taking a huge grain of salt, in fact buying a Siberian salt mine, to whatever the salesman tells you, because it's not quick and it's not easy to set up. In fact, in the client that I was at where we were doing that, it took about 18 months to get it in and actually get it embedded and do the transition from zero-based to driver-based. And the other thing is you need someone who is very, 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 very good at FP&A who's done it before. Really don't try and do it without getting some really solid, experienced people in or person in to help you along that journey, because it is a very different mindset. And actually, you're not just changing a sort of piece of technology, you're not just changing a model, you're actually changing the way, in many cases, FP&A people have done their jobs and thought about their jobs for 20 or more years. And so it's a cultural journey as much as it is, you know, a change of model or a change of tool.
Yeah, definitely. I think most of, like you mentioned, like more of that mindset shift of like, there is something else out there that could potentially be much more efficient and better and realistic, like we said earlier.
And I think as well, actually, it's just important to remind companies are doing this. It is real. I mean, we're probably on the early curve, but those companies that are getting a good grip on this are actually starting to leverage some real benefits out of it. So, you know, don't get stuck being the people who haven't moved with the times.
Evolution. It's where it's at. Constantly evolving. Now, before we wrap it up, I'm also curious about your perspective on the never-ending debate on ERP versus best of breed. So you mentioned in your workshop that the last step to building out a strategy is determining a viable alternative technology. Whether a company wants to go with a full scope ERP or take a more white glove approach with a best of breed model. So which approach do you find the most fitting for clients?
So I'm a sheep, right? When it comes to ERPs, I'm a sheep because I follow the herd. If there's no good reason not to follow the herd, I'll follow the herd. You know, I'll keep my eyes out because if the herd is jumping over a cliff to their doom, then I will be the one that stops unless the rest of the herd is going to carry me along over with it. But I tend not to like to go out on a limb. So if you'd asked me this question 6 months ago, I would have said, well, I would have probably kept going with best of breed. So it's, you know, the holy trinity of Salesforce and Workday and Oracle, SAP, financials, you know, is that golden triangle of front office, back office, and, you know, colleague management that just about everyone sort of coalesced around. And it might be little variations of that, but it, you know, that's kind of, we see that over and over and over again. And in fact, we went into a client and they were looking at this precise problem. And that was the very first thing I said was, you know, why are you looking outside of this? And they said, well, you know, we think that we can leverage more benefit out of a unified solution. And so, I started looking at some of our internal data from what we see clients doing, and there was definitely an uptick in a trend that we saw where some early bird clients, some leading edge clients, had started to go for a unified solution in Oracle, and it's actually relatively common Oracle, or at least it was. It had been tried before. So I was with a telco that tried to do a unified platform of CRM, billing, and financials. A massive project, and it kind of sort of worked, but didn't quite work, and the technology wasn't quite there. And they ended up pulling the financials and putting in SAP instead. And then they kind of thought, well, actually, this billing isn't really working for us. So they pulled the billing, and then they went, I think, to not Cognizant, but something similar. They ended up not unified. They ended up in best of breed. Mm-hmm. That was 12 years ago. But now we're starting to see that when the companies are using unified, actually they're being successful in doing it. Now, it is a compromise, right? You're not going to get the whizziness of Salesforce and the super-duper sexy-looking feel of Workday if you go all Oracle. And you're not going to get the strength and depth of Oracle financials and inventory management, you know, if you go for Workday. But companies are, you know, are choosing their unified platform, their suite, and they are implementing it and they are making a success out of it. And I think that's a trend that we will continue to see. And I think it's based on one very simple factor. It costs less and it is easier to manage, easier to get your data. And, you know, it to some extent is a holy grail that we've been aiming to get back to ever since we had mainframes back in, you know, 1985, which was the proper when we had proper computing.
Well, this conversation has been super informative. You've definitely touched on a lot of points in this conversation. So if our listeners wanted to learn more about digital strategy or digital transformations in general, what are some resources that you might suggest for them?
Well, you can email me at stuart.robb@thirdstage-consulting.com. That's always a quick way to get a quick answer. I mentioned YouTube. YouTube is a fabulous resource, really, for any form of information. Even us as consultants use YouTube to see, you know, kind of what's going on and what's evolving in the marketplace. So I'm a great fan of YouTube and also resources off the net. Gartner and Forrester reports are always very good for that kind of thing as well. For beyond budgeting, I've mentioned there are lots of books on beyond budgeting as well. So Amazon search for beyond budgeting, you'll find quite a lot there. And for target operating model, everybody has their own opinion as to how to do a target operating model. Most of them are wrong. So come to Third Stage and we'll tell you how to do it properly.
Third Stage is where it's at. Well, I wanted to thank you again for your time, Stuart. And until next time, I appreciate your time here.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarah.
And I want to thank all of you for listening today as well. Again, my name is Sarah Dokovic, and we'll see you next time on our next episode of the Digital Stratosphere podcast.
Contact Third Stage Consulting to see how we can help you reach the third stage of transformation success. Learn more about us and download independent reports, videos, and other best practices at thirdstage-consulting.com.